What's the real specter? I'm going to argue that the real specter is the Rothschilds. I'm going to argue that it is the banking peri boss system that they set up when Meyer sent his five sons all throughout Europe, as well as later on members making connections with banking houses in the U.S. August Belmont was one of the figures who was the front for the Rothschilds in coming to the United States. J.P. Morgan, many people argue, ends up being a kind of a Rothschilds front. And so they didn't just limit themselves to Europe. They actually, again, by the mid to late 1800s, had become the international banking house standard for the entire world, or for the Western world, or for the what was at that time the international standards market, the gold market, et cetera. They were really instrumental in all of that. They became the official gold brokers to the Bank of England. And that was, again, by the late 1800s that they'd achieved these really remarkable levels of dominance. But it's important to understand it wasn't just about banking and money. In fact, the Rothschilds many times over admitted that they had a vendetta against Christian civilization. They hated Christianity with a passion because, from their perspective, of course, they were committed to the Talmud. Meyer himself was a daily Talmudic reader. He would read the Talmud to the family. And of course, for those that don't know, that's the rabbinic traditions that are codified in the fourth and fifth centuries post-Christianity and post-Christ. So some of those traditions may have an older lineage. Some of those traditions are completely made up. They're superstitions. They're anything from Kabbalistic types of, ideas of magic to, superstitions about the washings of pots, the kinds of stuff that Jesus calls out when he's talking to the Pharisees throughout the gospel, particularly Matthew 23, where he calls out a lot of their hypocrisy. Who and where is this elite superstructure? If only we could identify who they are. Well, turns out we can. Turns out they've written all these books. They always go back to the same networks, the same elites. And that ties us back to what we call the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Chatham House rules that comes out of Chatham House in the UK and Pratt House in New York, which is its analog. It's the same groups that set these entities up. You get the roundtable groups that were birthed out of John Ruskin's ideas, birthed out of the ideas of Cecil Rhodes working as a front for the Rothschilds. In fact, it was the Rothschilds that gave Cecil Rhodes the money to begin his operations with the diamond mines and so forth. And so a lot of these entities, as you see from the classic, Sean Connery era Bond movies, again, Ian Fleming is writing about these groups and these networks. And you never see in the old Bonds the face of number one, right? He's got the cat, he's clouded by some obstruction, or they just simply never show his face. He's in the shadows, and that's intended to signify shadow government. You never know or see the names of the individuals that rule over you. If you remember the famous Edward Bernays text, which we've covered on my channel for many years, we covered it 10 years ago, lecturing through the whole book. Edward Bernays's famous book Propaganda, he was working at the behest of these same entities and groups. Bernays said at the very beginning of the book that Americans and those in the West, under the guise of, quote, democracy, they're actually controlled by people that they never even know their names. They don't know who is behind the wars. They don't know who's behind the revolutions and the coups in various governments.
All right, I want to hand the baton to Jay Dyer, but just if he'll humor me, he's a really smart researcher. Jay's analysis. What do you make of alumni of this particular node of the global government system through academia, with Bill Gates' daughter coming out and saying it's totalitarian, it's world government, it's how to rule the world, it's how to control people, how to dumb them down, and she's a horrible person? We've known they do this to the academia for a long time, and it's by invitation only. They have the, quote, good group that came out 15 years ago out of the Albert Einstein, university there in New York, their shadow world government. That's what this is. But the fact this is coming out now ought to really concern them. What do you make of the story? And I know you've got a full show loaded and ready. Jay Dyer, great to have you here, my friend.
Thank you. Well, I got to take my methylene blue first.
And it is, buy a bottle of that, get a bottle of methylene red free right now. So thank you for the support. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I had two bottles and they're almost empty now. So I've been running on methylene blue in my tank for the past couple months to do all these debates and all the stuff we've done lately. But yeah, I listened to your show last night. I thought, you know, you kind of went exactly where I was going to go, which is that if you're in academia, if you're in grad school, this is the kind of stuff that happens. They come to you, they recruit you, and sometimes they recruit you out of high school, depending upon, you know, who you are, your bloodline, all that kind of stuff. And I'm not at all surprised that we would see Bill Gates' daughter in the exact same situation, because I was on with you in studio a few months ago and we covered Changing Images of Man. And that's one of those elite textbooks that's written for grad schools. Now, it doesn't have to be secret because they know the public's never going to read this. So they don't mind publishing these kinds of textbooks. But when you see the textbooks written for higher grad, post-grad types of studies and classes that you get recruited into, that's where they really lay out all this stuff. So I think you did a really good job on last night's show and your yesterday's show when you connected it to Brzezinski's books, when you connected it to these, you know, Stanford Research, you know, Changing Images of Man style texts, because they lay it all out. They say, look, we're not going to call it evil world government, even though this class was ironically named that, probably tongue in cheek, but it really is that, right? It really is. How can we soft kill the public with dysgenics, with, you know, chemicals in the food and the water? How can we, you know, inoculate them, like they said 100 years ago in Bertrand Russell, to where they're sterilized? You know, Jonas Salk has two books on how to use inoculations to do all of that. So that's the thing, is like they put all this stuff in the books, but you have to do a little bit of reading to actually find it. But we're actually in this age, Alex, where, you know, the internet can actually compact that information, make it very accessible, very easy to find. And now we're at this war, we're at this battle where, are we going to get distracted with, you know, drama and who's, you know, humping who? Or are we going to look at what's really going on, the big picture? So I'm glad that yesterday you called it back to the big picture.
Well, can't wait to hear what you're about to cover now, Jay. Great to have you. Please break it down. Thank you.
Yep. So I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to kick it off with that, because if you guys remember when we covered Changing Images of Man, that was an elite textbook for international studies, for people going into, you know, these high level government types of positions, people at the level of Brzezinski. You heard Alex yesterday talking about Dr. Francis Boyle. We talked about the Kissinger chair, where people are rarely ever, if any at all, recruited into this position where you have this very high level steering committee type of position. And this is important because it's the types of steering committees and groups that were set up 100 plus years ago out of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That's all a Rothschild's front. And so I want to get back to that, because you heard Carlos called in earlier. Carlos is a long, he's probably been listening to Alex as long as I have, back to early 2000, 2001, 2003. And, you know, Carlos brought up, this is the Rothschild type of system. And that's a recurring theme here. We're doing some noticing, pattern noticing here, which you're not allowed to do. Makes you evil if you notice it, because this is the banking system that actually runs things. And so I've moved on. I'm reading some other histories of the Rothschilds now, past the Morton biography. And what's interesting is the espionage world that we have. I'm not going to go too deep into espionage, but I just want to point out that people think of it as James Bond. They think of it like, you know, spy movies or whatever, but that's not reality. The reality is, and there is some of that, but the reality is, like Ian Fleming talked about in his work throughout his life creating the character, he was putting real stories in, real events in. And I actually think that if you pay a lot of attention to the details, say in the Ian Fleming stories, you can begin to realize, as he himself says in biographies, I'm talking about real people that I interacted with, the real Spectre. So who is the real Spectre? Who's the real international terror organization that supplanted the Soviet Cold War battle that he began the novels with Smersh, which was actual NKVD counterintelligence? What's the real Spectre? I'm going to argue that the real Spectre is the Rothschilds. I'm going to argue that it is the banking peri boss system that they set up when Meyer sent his five sons all throughout Europe, as well as later on members making connections with banking houses in the U.S. August Belmont was one of the figures who was the front for the Rothschilds in coming to the United States. J.P. Morgan, many people argue, ends up being a kind of a Rothschilds front. And so they didn't just limit themselves to Europe. They actually again, by the mid to late 1800s, had become the international banking house standard for the entire world, or for the Western world, or for the what was at that time the international standards market, the gold market, et cetera. They were really instrumental in all of that. They became the official gold brokers to the Bank of England. And that was, again, by the late 1800s that they'd achieved these really remarkable levels of dominance. But it's important to understand it wasn't just about banking and money. In fact, the Rothschilds many times over admitted that they had a vendetta against Christian civilization. They hated Christianity with a passion because, from their perspective, of course, they were committed to the Talmud. Meyer himself was a daily Talmudic reader. He would read the Talmud to the family. And, of course, for those that don't know, that's the rabbinic traditions that are codified in the 4th and 5th centuries post-Christianity and post-Christ. So some of those traditions may have an older lineage. Some of those traditions are completely made up. They're superstitions. They're anything from Kabbalistic types of, ideas of magic to, superstitions about the washings of pots, the kinds of stuff that Jesus calls out when he's talking to the Pharisees throughout the gospel, particularly Matthew 23, where he calls out a lot of their hypocrisy. So those oral traditions, some of which were real and some of those which were not, were beginning even in Jeremiah's time to supplant the biblical message that had already been given, the revealed, text of the Torah and what the prophets and the writings of, David's Psalms had already laid down. So you get this recurring tendency towards being tempted with the doctrines of the nations that we see throughout the Old Testament. And the Israelites would continually fall into that. That's what the majority of the Old Testament is, Israel falling into that, having a huge defeat and disaster, being called to repentance, and then coming back to God, and then falling away again. Particularly the books of the Kings are full of that. And you notice that what they fell into was a lot of these occult practices, a lot of the pagan practices of the nations around them, the Valley of Hinnom and Topheth, where they would sacrifice their firstborn, their young. So these kinds of practices have always been a temptation. And the argument, I think, that many, and even today, scholars that are themselves Jewish academics, you could read Peter Schaefer, he has a book on Jesus and the Talmud. It discusses how they codified into the Talmudic debates and discussions in the Mishnah and in the various halakhic traditions of Jewish lore, as well as the Kabbalistic mystical tradition, a lot of these pagan ideas and occult practices. So there's a lot going on. In other words, you've got volumes and volumes and volumes of text that contain some elements of just Bible citations and then other elements of these sort of debates and traditions and speculations. And that's relevant because what's informing Meyer Rothschild as he's reading the Talmud every day, sort of reading it out loud to his family, because they would have these meals and then they would read this out loud at the mealtime. Is that it's really laying down a lot of principles that can be used. And we're going to set aside for just a moment the occult stuff. It's laying down principles also for how to maneuver and navigate in a society where you're the minority. So in other words, it's almost a kind of strategy of espionage. And I think that's also overlooked. There were some articles a few years ago talking about how the Chinese government was busy reading the Talmud. Now you think, why would the Chinese Communist Party, why would that government be interested in reading the Jewish Talmud? You can go find these articles. It was all in mainstream news. And it's because they were looking at techniques, practices, and principles about how to engage in banking subterfuge, business transactions, business deals, etc., in order to get the upper hand. And I think a lot of what's going on in these traditions and in these techniques, not everything, it's not all about spy stuff, but there is, even in the Old Testament, quite a few examples of espionage, assassinations, all these kinds of things. You have in the book of Judges, quite a bit of that. You have, Joshua, Caleb, and the spies going into the Promised Land. So there's a lot of espionage. And even in the books of the Kings, Chronicles, Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, you have quite a bit that has to do with courtly intrigue and espionage. So there's a lot that's there that I think people overlook or not aware of. A lot of people are biblically illiterate. And I know that the Talmud is not the same thing as the Bible, but it will contain, right? So you might have like a bunch of Talmudic tractates, and they're commenting on one biblical verse, and then you have all these sort of rabbinical debates about what it means. So you can have both and, right? And I'm not arguing for Judeo-Christian civilization. I think those two things are fundamentally at odds. In fact, the Jews themselves over and over and over will actually say this, that there is no Judeo-Christian civilization because, as Netanyahu has said many times over, he does not intend to lose the war again with Rome. And for the Judaic interpretation of these texts, they interpret Rome as the West in general, as Roman Catholic civilization, as Orthodox Christianity as well, because that's, for their mindset, part of Rome or Edom. All of those things are interpreted to mean anything that's not sort of promoting the Talmudic presuppositions and worldview. So that's what's informing the mindset of the Rothschilds when they begin their project of multi-generational taking over and subversion of the West. By the time of the Russo-Japanese War, in fact, I went to the Rothschilds archives, and this was on my Twitter. It got quite a bit of traction when I shared it. I went into the actual Rothschilds archives, and there's quite a bit that's there about the Russo-Japanese War. And the Rothschilds were actually the major funders of the Japanese government. They loaned something like 20, 21 million pounds to the Japanese government so that they could overthrow the Tsar. And the reason they wanted to do that was because they were unhappy with the contentions between Orthodox Christianity and Russia and, of course, the Russian Jews that had been there for so long. And you see this continual battle for particularly those areas, and a lot of, you know, what's happening even today in the Ukraine goes back to these ancient vendettas. It's almost like, you know, Dune, Khan Lee, the ancient art of vendetta that comes up in the novels so often. And you see that here with these sort of ancient vendettas, that the idea is that anyone that's opposed to anything or even mild criticism of what the Zionist state today is doing, which is not even necessarily identical to traditional rabbinic Judaism, which is why some rabbinic Jews disagree with Zionism. We find out that there's a large geopolitical subversion component to this as well. As we've noted for many years here in the Fourth Hour, and I remember I did interviews with a Syrian girl 10 years ago talking about the Oded Yanan plan, Greater Israel Project. I've been aware of that since 2005, 6, 7. So I've talked about that for a long time. And you have to be careful and nuanced here because it gets into a lot of history. But I'm pointing out that modern espionage actually comes out of Rothschild banking, and hardly anybody knows that or thinks about that. But when you read the biographies of the Rothschilds, they're very explicit about that. They're actually bragging about that. Interpol, a lot of these, you know, today's officialdom when it comes to law enforcement is early on very much private intelligence, private banking agents. And we're going to talk about Disraeli here in a moment, who was a Rothschild agent. This is the Alex Jones Show. Don't go anywhere. I'm Jay Dyer.
The program leftists failed to silence. It's the Alex Jones Show.
Welcome back to the Fourth Hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Now. So we're talking about the history of the Rothschild family again and their fundamental role, their essential role in the establishment of modern espionage and those networks that would essentially be the busy bees for the New World Order, those who are working for the good, not so much of the American people or the West or freedom or liberty, et cetera, but for the banking establishment, for the large banking houses that would over time begin to indebt the nation, put the nations into debt and make them essentially slaves to a massive global usury system. And this is what we see with the IMF, the World Bank. These are all Fabian socialist structures that were set up at the behest of the Milner, Fabian, Rothschild circles. So you see that if you talk about the Fabian socialists, we saw quite a bit of that in the news in the last few months with Keir Starmer and his stepping down, the rise of Fabian socialism in America, again, with people like Mamdani, who is essentially that type of ideology, where you have the combination of Islam and socialism and leftism as a tool of this supra elite this Spectre style organization that we're talking about. And if you watch the James Bond Spectre, the one that was more recent with Daniel Craig, that whole film is actually about the Five Eyes. It's about international espionage networks working at the behest of this elite oligarchical superstructure. Who and where is this elite superstructure? If only we could identify who they are. Well, turns out we can. Turns out they've written all these books. They always go back to the same networks, the same elites. And that ties us back to what we call the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Chatham House rules that comes out of Chatham House in the UK and Pratt House in New York, which is its analog. It's the same groups that set these entities up. You get the roundtable groups that were birthed out of John Ruskin's ideas, birthed out of the ideas of Cecil Rhodes working as a front for the Rothschilds. In fact, it was the Rothschilds that gave Cecil Rhodes the money to begin his operations with the diamond mines and so forth. And so a lot of these entities, as you see from the classic, you know, Sean Connery era Bond movies, again, Ian Fleming is writing about these groups and these networks. And you never see in the old Bonds the face of number one, right? He's got the cat. He's clouded by some, you know, obstruction, or they just simply never show his face. He's in the shadows. And that's intended to signify shadow government. You never know or see the names of the individuals that rule over you. If you remember the famous Edward Bernays text, which we've covered on my channel for many years, we covered it 10 years ago, lecturing through the whole book. Edward Bernays' famous book, Propaganda, he was working at the behest of these same entities and groups. Bernays said at the very beginning of the book that Americans and those in the West, under the guise of, quote, democracy, they're actually controlled by people that they never even know their names. They don't know who is behind the wars. They don't know who's behind the revolutions and the coups in various governments. They have all of these phony patsies, as you see here in this scene that's very illustrative, right? Those are the front people, the Emilio Largo, the guy with the patch there, right? In that installment of Bond, he takes the heat and ends up fighting James Bond. But James Bond doesn't end up fighting number one of Spectre. He ends up fighting one of the minions, one of the heads of the Hydra of Spectre. And so when you see the global terror organizations out there in the world, we talk about a Bin Laden, right, or a al-Baghdadi, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and a Jolani, right? These are the minions, the heads of these terror organizations, and they can be dispensed with. In fact, when the Western operation of Timber Sycamore, which put $1 billion plus into the overthrow of Assad, that was admitted in the New York Times. We wrote about that 10 plus years ago. We didn't know the name of the project until it was declassified as Timber Sycamore. That was tons and tons and tons of U.S. taxpayer money put into overthrowing Assad. And eventually they succeeded with Israeli help via the CIA to install Jolani. And then we saw not too long ago, I think, wasn't Netanyahu calling for the removal of Jolani? So you see one of the heads there of the Hydra, one of the heads, one of the snakes can be immediately cut off when he's no longer useful. And again, Ian Fleming is really just telling you all of that in the movies. I'm not saying you can figure out everything in the world through movies. You can actually figure out quite a bit, though. But because a lot of the movies are propaganda and they're exaggerated. But again, when you find this commonality, you know, from the time of Fleming's stories back in the 50s and 60s, all the way up into Spectre with Daniel Craig, it's the same model, right? Spectre is basically meeting in Rome. It's like a Club of Rome Bilderberg style meeting. And you've got this shady guy sitting over in the shadows. And that scene is classic because they actually lay out all the criminal stats. It's like a business meeting, but that's for criminal operations. And so they're saying, you know, we've only trafficked 200,000 people in the Congo this year. Drug sales are illegal. Drug sales are down 3 billion. We're up with, black market operations in this other place. So they're basically laying out a business report. And that's how organized crime actually works. It's a business. But as Alex pointed out, with our global elite, the organized crime is also under the superstructure of something like Spectre. So they can run front operations, they can run clean businesses, and also run dirty black ops businesses. And that's why even within these intelligence organizations, it's compartmentalized, and you can have groups that run the black ops, and then you can have the white hats, the good guys, that don't know what the compartmentalized black ops operations are up to. And it's always been that way. We go back again to Meyer Rothschild. When he sent his sons out, he knew that some nations in Europe were more liberal and lean more liberal, but he knew that other nations lean more conservative. So he would send the conservative sons to the conservative countries and the more liberal sons to the liberal countries. And he pointed out that we don't have an ideology. We are interested in gaming the markets and then moving the money based on the long-term expectations of where the markets go. And I think that's instructive for us because so many people in the West are not trained to think in terms of long-term. We don't think about future generations and how do we win a long-term battle. We think about the here and the now. We think about some stupid news story that will be forgotten in 4 days. And we're not thinking about long-term. And that's why it's really important to not just talk about news, but to actually have a worldview that you can pass on to your children, something that grounds your ethics and your motivations and your life beyond just news stories or just the immediate drama of the day. You need a worldview. That's why I promote Orthodox Christianity as a good, solid worldview that you can pass on that's showing a lot of strength in America. I've had numerous mainstream media outlets just recently asking to interview me to talk about this that's happening. Most of the time, I just ignore the mainstream media interviews. I don't even do it because it's not necessary. They're dying anyway. But it shows that the system has taken note of this. The New York Times even wrote a whole story about the rise of Orthodox Christianity and how all of these evil, toxically masculine young dudes are getting interested in this kind of stuff. Well, it's because they're searching for answers and they're looking for something beyond the nonsense that the system is offering. The system itself and what it's been putting out is beginning to collapse and eat itself. Yeah, there you said, I think that's the New York Times article from a little while back. And we've even seen high-level globalist publications begin to also note that this rise in young men converting to Orthodoxy and stuff like that, it's a Russian operation. Somehow Putin's behind that. Totally ignoring all the history that most of the Russian church, for example, in the West, most of those people are people that were expatriate. They're white Russian founded. They were fleeing the Bolsheviks. So if Putin is KGB, as the neocon media tells us, why would he be running all of the groups that fled Soviet and NKVD persecution? It doesn't make any sense. And if you get into the Matryoshkin archives, we did a whole podcast on this. The Matryoshkin archives actually vindicate the fact that when the Soviets were running their operations in the Russian church to control it, they really focused mainly on key high-level patriarchs and bishops. They weren't concerned with every single parish priest throughout the jurisdictions of the Russian Orthodox Church. They were mainly concerned with specific Eastern Bloc patriarchates and Eastern Bloc elite powers, not every priest everywhere. And so they focused on the Moscow Patriarchate for some decades, and they focused on, say, Bulgaria and the Patriarchate of Bulgaria for some decades. Because at that time, the ecumenical patriarchate was already admittedly on the side of the CIA. In fact, there's declassified communications and admissions that the EP back in the 1950s and 60s was already subservient to and serving the CIA, the OSS, and then CIA. And that had to do with what was going on in Greece as well. You know, we've done interviews with John Kiriakou several to a couple times now, two long-form interviews. And, you know, Kiriakou was stationed in Greece for many years. And so he has a very good assessment of kind of what the CIA's role in Greece has been for a long time. And that helps to explain why the Ecumenical Patriarchate and the role, obviously, of Constantinople as a key geopolitical point, why Constantinople's EP, which is Greek, why it would be siding with the West. That's exactly why, for example, you have this schism in the Ukrainian church because the EP is on the side of the State Department and the CIA, obviously. When they set up that CIA church, you had CIA bragging about it. The State Department bragged about it. Yeah, I would say go to my channel. You can check out that long 2-hour interview on YouTube where we went really deep with Kiriakou. And I basically took every one of my conspiracy theories, so-called, and presented them to him and said, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? What do you think about this? And I would say about 90% of what we talked about in his assessment, he agreed with it. So I'm not saying it's true because he agreed with it. That's not a fallacy of appeal to authority. It's just a witness, expert witness testimony. So to get back to the Rothschilds, though, when we look at this model of what they set up as a good strategy, it began with, in the late 1890s, this model of a secret society called the Society of the Elect, that they would essentially put Cecil Rhodes as one of their key front people, the heading up of this secret society. And his idea, their idea was, we'll have these apostles, they call them apostles. And this included people like, I think Cardinal Manning was one of the, because he was a English cardinal that they wanted as part of this. They recruited about 2,000 or 3,000 academics out of Oxford, Eton, and Cambridge. And the idea was that these were the outer realm called the helpers. These were the helpers of the inner apostles. And it was structured like a Jesuit model. I'm not saying the Jesuits ran this. I'm saying it was structured based on a Jesuit model. And this was Cecil Rhodes' own idea. He talks about this in his biography and in his last will and testament, that they would use combination of Freemasonic models and structures and the Jesuit model of cells, a cell structure. So you have a superior general, but you have essentially, you report to a smaller type of head of your order. And so that decentralized, compartmentalized structure was more advantageous than having something totally top down. And the original idea was that this would be a reinvigorating of the British Empire. We would make the Anglo-Saxon British power the ultimate power once again. We would reclaim, this is what Cecil Rhodes and the Rothschilds were saying at that time, we'll reclaim the American colonies which had rebelled against us. We'll bring them back into the fold, and we'll establish what we might call, Lord Curtis said, a Commonwealth of God, which we would be in a quasi-socialist world federation. And so we might even retitle it, not even the British Empire, because empire was beginning to get kind of a negative connotation. The idea was kind of a world democratic socialist federation headed up by Anglo-Saxon peoples in the UK. This project failed. It did not work. Britain started going bankrupt. They had World War One came about, and World War One, this entity thought would be successful because they would set up the League of Nations. The purpose of World War One was to have a League of Nations, which was, quote, explicitly a Fabian socialist model of world governance. That also failed. They did not succeed in getting America to be fully on board with the League of Nations, and so it didn't work. But they went back to the drawing board and began to strategize again with massive banking power and support. And they did, however, get the nation state of Israel established, or at least the Balfour Declaration, right around that time in 1917. So even though World War One didn't give all the objectives, they were able to establish some objectives. And if we go back to Moses Hess, again, the founder of modern utopian socialism, Moses Hess says in his book, Rome versus Jerusalem. Now notice, this exact same title that Netanyahu talks about consistently, saying that he's fighting this multi-8-front war because they don't want to lose to Rome again. Now, remember, Rome is not just a city. It's not just the Roman Catholic Church. It's all of Western civilization and anything, quote, Christian, generally speaking. That's the battle that Rabbinic Judaism sees itself engaged in. And they have to do this to bring about through things like Tikkun Olam, various practices that they believe in, will eventually bring the Moshiach, their Messiah, which we think would be Antichrist. So Revival of Israel tells you, and this was written back before there was such a thing as Zionism. This was written in 1862. And he says, I am already in contact with the Rothschild brothers. And the Rothschild brothers are very open to and hoping to support the idea of setting up a nation state of Israel. They are open to this and want to support it. 1860s, you see this was being planned. Now, the term Zionism doesn't exist yet, but it doesn't have to, because that's, I think they're looking at the Balfour Declaration there with Lord Jacob, and that's BB with Lord Jacob. They're looking at it. But the idea was to continue this model of governance that's a superstructure of specter. And it's not even through these phases in the 20s, 30s, 40s, it's still not totally Zionist. For example, when the Balfour Declaration was being proposed, many of the British elite were actually Arabophiles and were opposed to the establishment of a nation state of Israel or a Zionist state. Many of the Arabophiles, like T.E. Lawrence, Gertrude Bell, a lot of the spies that they sent out, St. John Philby, at least verbally, they were opposed to a Zionist state. They fell in love with Arabic culture. And so there's always been this interesting divide between the British elite, between those who favor and like Islam. We've seen even King Charles was inducted into a Sufi order. He loves Shia Islam. So, I mean, they always have this affinity at times for that. And then other members of the British power structure and elite, like the Rothschilds, have tended, obviously, to be pretty much, I mean, there's a few outliers amongst the family, but pretty much pro-Zionist, 100%, all the way back to the 1860s. And, of course, it's Edmund the Rothschild that was the major supporter. Yeah, there's Charles with his, I'm trying to remember, I think he underwent something Shia. I mean, he's been given awards and swords from Sunni Muslims, too. And in his mindset, like Charles' mindset, it's not a big deal because he's a perennialist, right? King Charles is an open supporter of the Sophia Perennis, perennial wisdom. And he believes that, I think, because that ties into the eco ideology. A lot of the perennialists think that ecology is a key element of, you know, saving the earth and creating, you know, some future high tiered neo-feudal order. And many technocrats also agree with that. A lot of the Nick Land style technocrats have this idea of creating a technocratic neo-feudal order. Anyway, but to go back to the point of the Zionists here is that the socialist, quasi-atheist Zionist movement isn't antithetical to Fabian socialism. In fact, they're all kind of under the general heading, you could say, of socialism. And the Rothschilds have had a history of not always supporting Marxism, socialism, but also being open to supporting it when it's necessary. So you have to think about what Myers said a long time ago. Myers said his number one allegiance was to his own family. And then, of course, to Judaism second. So family and Judaism are a strength for, whether you agree with or disagree with, it's a strength for long-term success and long-term operations. And that's exactly what he taught his sons to do. And that's why they were so successful, is that they had these allegiances and they were not tied to specific king squabbles or specific nation-state European squabbles. They were above that and looked beyond that. And so likewise for us, we are still in this country caught up in a GOP versus DNC mindset. We can't get past these squabbles because we exist in a fractured state of ideology, many, many generations removed from what is historic Christianity, for example. And so we have all these competing minutia sects and all this squabbling. And we don't have any unifying ideology that we can rally behind as our fundamental starting point. But that's precisely why, of course, the Rothschilds understood the advantage of undermining and attacking Christian civilization, particularly theologically. So we think that theology doesn't matter. It's all football stuff and battles. That's not what they think. They think it's very important to control the churches, subvert the churches, utilize operatives and agents. As I mentioned earlier, I said this character, Disraeli. Disraeli was, of course, the first Jewish lead politician in Britain. And that was something that had never been seen before, because prior to that, Christian nations had certain laws about limitations of Jews and what they could and couldn't do in terms of public office. And it was the Rothschilds in England that succeeded in eventually getting these agents and these operatives in place so that the laws could be changed so that they could have a public-private alliance between their banking power and the state. And not just a role where they're the guarantors of the Bank of England's gold, but specifically alliances with the state itself. In other words, to have Rothschilds as members of the British Parliament, not just the lower house, but also the upper house, which eventually succeeded when they convinced the Queen that a Rothschild could be in government. And how did they do that? Well, initially, the Queen said, Victoria said, no, not in my time. We're not going to have a Rothschild be one of these, sitting members of lower house or upper house. And they said, what if Disraeli is able to get you the Suez Canal? And she says, if you can get me that, then yes, I'll allow it. And so they basically fronted the money to purchase Suez Canal from an Egyptian Shia, I forget his name. But there was a guy in Egypt who happened to be a Shia ruler, and he at that time was low on money. And so they were able to front the money to get the Suez Canal. That is what Disraeli achieved in his operation, as an explicit agent of the Rothschilds. But I want to note that with Disraeli, who was presented as a conservative in his earlier days, he had written for socialist publications. And this is what the new book I'm reading about, the Rothschilds and Disraeli, what they explain. And there was a book, I believe Disraeli wrote a book called Koningsby. And much like Edwin Mandel House wrote a book where Philip Drew administrator, he's talking about being an operative for this secret cabal to Woodrow Wilson, just like Colonel Edwin Mandel House is sort of a handler to Woodrow Wilson. You have the same situation with essentially Disraeli being handled by the Rothschilds, and he writes a novel telling the story. It's called Koningsby. I've not read the novel yet. I'm just saying that this is what's described in the history of Disraeli as he essentially achieves this ascendancy through getting the Suez Canal for the British government. And that you see is very, that's why, for example, these ports and these straits like Hormuz are very important for controlling of resources. And I want to remind you that what did our friend Jeff Stein McCaffrey, Jeffrey Epstein, what did he say in his emails that were eventually published? I work for the Rothschilds. I am the front, the legate, the attaché for the Rothschilds. It was also the steering committee, trilateral commission, legate of David Rockefeller. So what better proofs of a conspiracy than that? This is the Alex Jones Show, and your guest host, Jay Dyer.
I'm going to tell you something right now that is one of the most, if not the most important things I've ever talked about on air. And I want you to really listen to me. And I want you to get a pen and paper out of your iPhone, out of your Droid, and type this into your notes. And I want you at lunch today or tonight or right now to just go to any search engine you want and type in two different names, two different words, okay? Two different drugs that have won Nobel Prizes, you name it, that people don't want you to know about. And one of those is ivermectin that everybody knows about. The other one that most people still don't know about is mebendazole. If you do the research, then it's important to understand that you need to get it from a pharmacy. You need to get it from a doctor. And we have a sponsor, and that's, of course, Bigley. And they went and they used the same service as, you know, the big web, RXs, and great people we've used that have been sponsors to the past. But this is Bigley doing it. And the key is, it's real, it's pharmaceutical, and it is a very low price. People are selling knockoffs of it online without a prescription, and a lot of it's fake or a lot of it's watered down and adulterated. Because I did a regimen a couple years ago of mebendazole. We'll put that on screen. That's how you spell it right there. Mebendazole, and it didn't have any effect. I bought it off of Amazon. And then I did more research, and they said most of that stuff's fake. So I went and I got it from a doctor, and it was incredible. And my own medical doctor owns clinics all over the state of Texas, had already been pushing it on me for years, and I just never done it. Ladies and gentlemen, you can get the two in a combo, the ivermectin and the mebendazole together, and they work synergistically together. It is certified and known, both of them, as incredible anti-parasite. Just search the term ivermectin, minbezidol, and just put in study and do your own research and see what the system has been suppressing about this. So this is something, in my view, talk to your physician, and when you go to the website, it's your online pharmacy, and they've got nurses, doctors, all of it, and then you get the prescription. It's very, very easy to do, and I would recommend to talk to your doctors. My own personal opinion, what I do for myself is twice a year, I take a regimen of ivermectin and mebesidol, and it is incredible. People ask, why I look so young while I'm healthy. Well, it's a cocktail of things. It's the ivermectin. It's the minbezidol that I take about twice a year as a regimen. Some people, my medical doctor says, take a little bit of ivermectin every week, but I tend to forget to do that. It's literally just to take like two pills a week as a supplemental. That's what my medical doctor tells me. You get your own medical doctor to tell you what you want. But the big thing they say is a couple times a year, a big dose, a big regimen. You talk to your physicians. You talk to the folks in the online pharmacy. Let me put it on screen for you. 1776RX, just 1776RX.health. This is one of the most important things you'll ever do, ladies and gentlemen. And despite the system trying to suppress this information, it's getting out everywhere. So do your own research. This is revolutionary. This is so important. 1776, just the numbers. 1776RX.health. Those are the coordinates, and it's a win-win to fund our operation and what we're doing. Take action now. The most important decisions you'll ever make, 1776RX.health, and get your ivermectin, mebesidol right now, ladies and gentlemen. But whatever you do, go to the AlexShowStore.com. These are incredible products. All these things work. They don't have sexy names. Irish sea moss, Shilajit, bovine colostrum. Oh, research bovine colostrum and then find out we have the best. Oh, research Irish sea moss. We have the best. Research Shilajit. We have the best. We just bring you things the bad guys don't want you to know about at theAlexShowStore.com and, of course, at 1776RX.health. Take action now. Thank you so much for your support.